And welcome in to another edition of My Car Guru, and we wrap up the week this week as we come your way here on this Friday morning.
Yes, it is weekend time. Who's Tennessee play this weekend?
They play Neyland Stadium.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, that should be interesting.
Well, Kentucky tends to give them a good game a lot of times. I think if Tennessee can eliminate some of the mistakes they made against Georgia a little bit, cut back on some of that, I think they'll be in good shape.
We won half that game.
Yeah, although they still did some things in the first half that really wasn't very good, but they really kind of imploded in the second half, and Georgia helped them a little bit. But when you come out, fumble, interception, fumble, that's tough to overcome.
Yeah, you know, we were talking earlier about some of these dramatic injuries that we've seen lately, like Dak Prescott,
yeah, that was,
Dallas Cowboys.
That was terrible.
That made me think about the couldn't help but reminisce about the injury to Joe Theismann that was caught. That was Monday Night Football, I believe.
It was. Remember who did the hit on him?
No.
Who made the hit on him?
No.
Lawrence Taylor.
Oh, was it Lawrence Taylor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that leg just kind of snapped in two, didn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Old Dak's foot was pointing in the wrong direction, wasn't it?
Yeah, when you look down and your foot's kind of about, what would that be, 120 degrees from where it was, it's over 90 degrees the other way. That's not good.
I had that happen playing basketball. It didn't happen to me. It happened to a good friend. And he's a real estate agent in Greenville. This was back when 3 days a week we played basketball at the YMCA during lunch.
Mm-hmm.
I was in really good shape. That was in my late 30s and early 40s that mm-hmm. we were doing that. And I threw him a pass, and he trapped the ball pretty much on the floor. I mean, when he caught it. Mm-hmm. And the way he caught it jammed his pinky finger. And his pinky finger, instead of pointing straight up, it was in the shape of an L.
Mm.
Pointing outside.
Mm.
And he just held up his hand and went, oh, 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 you know. And so he went to the emergency room. All he had to do was just pop it in the right direction, you know. But, yeah, when your joints are going the wrong direction. That happened also to me when I was playing basketball at Greenville High School. I was a junior. My brother was a senior. We were on a fast break, and he was ahead of me. And he planted his leg going up for a layup, and the knee bent the wrong direction.
Hyperextended.
Yeah, and tore his ACL. That was the end of his basketball career. See, back then in the 70s, they didn't have all these patellar tendon transplants and, mm-hmm. you know, all of this sophisticated ACL surgery where they actually replace your ACL with either a cadaver ligament or, something.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, they just kind of worked around it, you know, moved some things around. I'm trying to remember the doctor in Johnson's. Dr. Walter Chapman. I don't know if you ever remember.
I remember that name, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was an orthopedic surgeon in Johnson City at the time and had a practice up here. And then he ended up moving to Greenville and had a long, long career down there. Wonderful Walter Chapman. He's done a lot of work on Lanny Lawson, that's for sure.
I didn't realize your brother was just, is he just a year older than you?
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
But
he was 2 years older, mm-hmm. but just one. I started school early. I was just so smart.
Okay.
No, for some reason or another, my mom, I wish she hadn't done this, but she made the decision to start me in the first grade when I was five.
Mm-hmm.
I was a November birthday.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was either going to be really old in my class or really young, and she chose the young route. She thought it would be better if we were there just 1 year separating us in school.
Yeah.
So, it worked out.
So that's how that happened.
Yeah, I mean, I have a radio show.
Yeah.
Now so you. Not play, everybody has that.
That's true. Now, you played for Herb Hawks back then.
I did, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the Greenville High School basketball team and Greenville High School tennis. I played tennis there.
Mm-hmm.
Got whipped pretty bad. Yeah, there were just our tennis program. I was probably as good as the number three player. I was playing number one for the Greenville High tennis team my
mm-hmm.
senior year.
Mm-hmm.
I was the best player we had. I was about as good as the number four guy at Dobbins Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I played the number one guy,
mm-hmm.
he made me look silly. Silly!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was kind of embarrassing. But anyway, I got to compete, right?
Sure.
We didn't have soccer back then. I think I would have enjoyed soccer.
Yeah, I hate it when they call it football.
You hate it?
Don't you? when they call soccer football.
Well, no, I mean, if that's it really makes more sense than calling what we do football.
That's true, and you hear it from overseas, you know, where soccer, of course, is big time. But I don't know. There's something about it. I don't like it when they.
Well, things don't always go the way you like.
They don't, for some reason.
You know, and I've seen that so many times. We've got a couple new people at Gateway right now, and we're working on turning them into professional retail automobile salespeople. You know, and part of that's a multifaceted job. That is just not standing out on the lot and greeting customers and selling cars.
Mm-hmm.
Selling cars is not easy. It's not an easy way to make a living, and it's just unbelievably different than it was back when I first started. I sold my first car in 1977. Mm-hmm. It was a Chevy Impala, green.
Mm-hmm.
Danny Lamb.
Big old Chevy.
Was the guy. Yeah. Well, no, they weren't big in 77. 76
right.
was
right.
the last year
That's
of the big
right.
one.
Yeah.
And they had just come out with this smaller one.
Okay.
And people said, well, those won't sell.
Yeah.
You know, people aren't going to, because, you know, gas was expensive. And
the Malibus were smaller, too.
Yeah. Everything got smaller.
Yeah.
And so what used to be a full-size car, now the full-size car was about the size of the previous mid-size car.
Right.
And so Danny Lamb and his wife showed up on the lot one day, and I went out. That's back when I used to wear. We required all our salespeople to wear a coat and tie,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I just went out, and I knew the product pretty well, but I didn't know anything about selling or understanding needs and wants. You know, the interview process. I didn't know what questions to ask. And see, back then, financing was different. I mean, nobody financed a car very few people financed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But when they did finance a car, they financed for 36 months, something like that. You didn't have the long terms that we have. And so one of the big parts of our job was to, and any salesperson, is to prospect. You know what prospecting is, right? It's just like, mm-hmm. you know, searching for gold, like mm-hmm. the old prospectors, you know, mm-hmm. you're panning for gold and stuff like that. So prospecting is about business development. You know, it's trying to create something, create an opportunity, as opposed to just waiting for the opportunity to walk in the front door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like your salespeople here at the radio station. If they just sit here and just wait for somebody to walk in the door and start advertising with them, you're not going to sell a lot of advertising.
Nope.
You know, you've got to walk and knock on doors and go into businesses, and that's tough right now, you know, because a lot of businesses
mm-hmm.
don't want you in there, mm-hmm. and, you know, you have to do a lot of stuff virtually, But back then, prospecting was a different thing. I remember my sales managers who I was working for, even though my dad owned the dealership, I was a salesperson, and dad wanted me to just do like everybody else did. So he threw me a phone book, and he said, start calling people. I said, what? He said, yeah, just start with the A's and just go through there and just start calling people.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, what do I say? You know? He said, well, ask them if they're in the market to buy a car. I said, well, that seems kind of random. He said, just do it. Okay, so I picked up the phone book and started going through there, and I would get these house. You know, back then people had phones in their houses.
Really?
Actually had
wow.
phone lines and stuff like that.
How about that?
And so you would call, and lots of times there would be somebody there.
Yeah, can you imagine?
And they would answer the phone.
Wow.
And say, Mrs. Johnson, this is Lenny Lawson, and I work at Lawson Chevrolet. He said, why are you calling me? Well, I was just calling because my boss said I needed to call and see if anybody wanted to buy a car. Well, we already bought one. We don't buy Chevrolets. We buy Ford. You know, so that's what you would run into. And your mm-hmm. your failure rate was very high.
Mm-hmm. But what about if you just got that one or two prospects?
Well, I mean, and that's what you it's kind of like going fishing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to throw it out there
mm-hmm.
enough. But you also have to use the right bait.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fast forward to today, we've got social media. And when you call somebody's number, if they don't recognize your number, see, we didn't know who was calling before, right?
Right.
So if they don't recognize your number, say, who is this calling me? I don't recognize that number. Mm-hmm. So it goes to voicemail. And you leave a voicemail message. And that has to be compelling, you know, to get somebody to call you back.
Yeah.
The ideal is to handle it a totally different way. I look at prospecting as not trying to sell a stranger something, either by mail or over the phone or in person. prospecting just means, to me, introducing yourself to people. You know, just like the teller at the bank,
mm-hmm.
The fella behind the counter, you know, at the 7-Eleven where you shop for coffee, the gas station attendant that you say hi to twice a week already, even strangers, letting them know who you are, letting them know what you do, and let them know where you work. You know, I tell my salespeople, when you go out, you should have your name tag on, and you should have business cards in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody is a prospect, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're all driving something. They did not ride a horse to work. Well, somebody may have, but anyway, a lot of new salespeople, and what we teach our salespeople now is, you're not trying to sell cars, okay? You're trying to make friends. You're trying to make people aware. Meet as many people as you can, so that when they are ready to buy something, guess whose name pops up?
Mm-hmm.
Yours, because you're the only one that they know in the car business.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be naturally outgoing. You cannot be an introvert and be good at sales. You have to be a conversationalist. You have to be genuinely interested in people. If you are not, then, you know, that's going to come across with folks. But still, that whole philosophy of not obviously trying to push something, trying to sell something, you're just gathering information. We've got a new, I hired a guy to be in charge of commercial sales. And by commercial sales, I mean any business. It could be a public utility or whatever, you know, where we have to bid, you know, to get the sale, or it could just be visiting businesses and small companies, large companies to work on their needs and to help them manage their fleets,
mm-hmm.
and be a total solution provider. Not only can we help you buy the right vehicles, we can put different types of beds, from flat beds to toolbox beds, all these different type of applications, but also, you know, we can be a service solution for you. And a lot of salespeople say, well, I'm not really in the service department. It doesn't matter. You work at a car dealership, and you can smooth the process for people who are wanting to buy commercial vehicles and need their commercial vehicles to be reliable and available when they need them. And when they break down, you can be the go-to person for them. Because I guarantee you, if you are a solution provider to somebody, when they get in the market to buy a car, they're going to call you first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important for them to know. So that's what prospecting is all about, and what we teach our salespeople, especially our new salespeople, to do, and encourage our existing salespeople to do the same thing.
So not just salespeople, but prospectors.
That's right.
Yeah.
Prospecting for gold.
All right. We'll take our first break. We'll be right back. And we're back. Friday morning, My Car Guru with Lenny Lawson.
Hi.
We're back.
We are back.
We back.
Well, I had a customer the other day ask me, when are all internal combustion engines going to go away, Mr. Guru? I said, well, I don't have a crystal ball on that, but it's sooner than later.
Well, if you were in California, I think they want them by, what, 2035?
2035 is what the rule is, that they are going to actually ban the sale of new vehicles with internal combustion engines in them. Infrastructure issues, you know, is replacing gas stations with charging stations, range anxiety, you know, figuring out the battery technology so that, you know, you can actually go 400 or 500 miles on a charge and not have to worry about it. There's a lot of hurdles to get over, but combustion engine vehicles are doomed. And the primary reason is because they rely on oil.
Yeah.
And, you know, with all of the emphasis on, you know, carbon monoxide and the environment and all that stuff, there's going to be enough of a progressive push as governments change. You know, we go from conservative to progressive and liberal and stuff like that. I mean, this ebb and flow kind of... It kicks the can down the road for a while, and then another party takes control, and they reel it back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But we're eventually, the trend line is that electric vehicles are going to be it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does make sense. You know, many years ago, there was another type of pollution that was a problem, and it was horse manure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And I mean, because you think about in big cities and places like that, with everybody getting around on horses and buggies and wagons mm-hmm. and stuff like that, you know, it created a big problem. I mean, in the Times, the British newspaper, the Times, in 1894, the headline was that the London streets would be buried under 9 feet of manure in 50 years if we don't do something.
Somebody needs to invent a car.
Right. So yeah. What prevented that from happening was the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right at the beginning, people could buy electric cars. I mean, there were battery-operated vehicles back in the early days of, mm-hmm. of automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy a electric or a combustion engine car. The latter had a massive handicap getting their engines started. I mean, people often broke their arms or died trying to start vehicles with a crank.
Trying to crank it.
Yeah. But then this guy named Charles Kettering invented the electric starter.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, that single invention helped kill electric vehicles.
Hmm.
And made internal combustion engines easier
right.
to use.
Yeah.
Range difference did the rest and finished them off. But with the push for electric cars, Tesla and even Nissan, you know, because Nissan came out with the Leaf. It was one of the earliest production vehicles, although it had a minimal range of about 150 miles. It still advanced the conversation,
mm-hmm.
okay? But, you know, with the push, combustion engine cars will fade away for the same reasons that carriages and horses are not mainstream anymore. Electricity is a renewable asset. Even if current batteries are not, they are recyclable. They may not be an issue now, but much like gasoline was not a problem, you know, back in the 1900s, these issues are going to become more prevalent and make this move to electric vehicles happen sooner than later. Within a couple months, I'll have my first electric Mach-E, the Mustang electric vehicle. I'm already installing charging stations at the dealership. I'll have 8 charging stations.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have 4 of them inside and 4 of them outside. I guess the ones inside are for vehicles that we're working on, vehicles that we need to charge, you know, before we put them out there on the lot. It's just going to be a different world. You know,
yeah.
As far as that's concerned.
I have no issue with it, the total changeover coming. What I would like to see, though, is when you can pull into a charging station, like a filling station, a gas station now, and there's about 10 pumps available, I want to see about at least 10 to 12 charging stations in that one location, so that way you don't have to sit and wait so long.
Yeah, well, the problem is just the time that it takes to charge one. I mean, and you can't get a full charge. It takes about 40 minutes to get about an 80% charge.
They've got to eliminate or bring that down to just a couple minutes.
And they are. I mean, the technology is advancing, and we will, you know, Tesla is got a big head start. They'll probably produce 500,000 vehicles in the coming year. And when the new truck comes out, you know, that's going to be a niche vehicle, I think, for a while. But with General Motors, with Ford, General Motors is hooking up with a electric vehicle maker. Ford has hooked up with Rivian, and they've got the new full electric F-150 that will be here by 2022. A lot of hybrid. Next year, this 2021, we'll have a hybrid F-150 for the first time. And so the advancements are coming. Maybe that's possible by 2035 to ban the sale of internal combustion engines in California. At least that's what they're saying, but a lot can change between now and then.
Yeah, that's 15 years down the road.
That's right.
All right, we'll take our last break, and we'll come back and wrap things up. And we're back to wrap things up for not only this Friday, but for the week on My Car Guru.
Have you ever wondered why a stop sign is shaped like it
why
is?
Why it's an octagon?
Yeah. And why is it red?
I used to know this stuff, but right off the top of my head, I don't remember.
Well, the first stop signs were posted in Michigan and in Nebraska somewhere around 1915, according to Brown University.
Were they yellow?
They were not red.
Yep.
Yeah, they were yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So why is it shaped like an octagon? Well, the American Association of State Highway Officials saw a few key advantages to giving the stop sign its unique shape. First, the octagonal shape made it easy for drivers traveling in the opposite direction to recognize that the sign that they were seeing for the other person was, in fact, a stop sign.
Makes sense, yeah.
You know, so it helps prevent confusion at intersections. And second, since the original signs weren't reflective, they needed a design that could be easily recognizable mm-hmm. at night. So was the stop sign always red? No, it was not. Multiple revisions were made, but up until the 1950s, stop signs generally featured a yellow background with black letters and a black outline. In 1954, the stop sign got a makeover, according to Reader's Digest, resulting in its current look, a white outline and lettering against a red background. So mm-hmm. that's almost totally useless information that you now own.
Some of those yellow ones with the marbles in the letters that yeah. stop the reflective marble, that's worth quite a bit of money.
Oh, are they now?
Yeah, yeah.
Coming from the antique collector.
If you run across one of those, if it's in good shape, you're probably looking at several hundred dollars.
Keep it, right?
Yeah.
Buy it and hold.
Absolutely.
It's like Ford stock.
Hey, that's going to do it for My Car Guru for this week, and hope everybody has a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.
Okay, see you then.